Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 380. Jason, would you let us know what we're talking about?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 380 authorizes the Department of Justice to suspend, revoke, or refuse to renew the registration of a person as a telephone seller, and it specifies those conditions.
Pete, do you want to...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Department of Justice sponsored this measure and would urge your support for the bill. The context of it is simply this. Persons who engage in telemarketing, which in the Oregon statutes is not just everybody who sells things on the telephone, but rather people who use prize promotions or the award of free gifts, free vacation giveaways, for example, to promote their products. Persons such as that are required to register with the Oregon Department of Justice. The registration procedure includes providing us with a copy of the registration of the script that they propose to use in telemarketing. The requirement of registration has been a very effective tool in our effort to combat the worst of the worst telemarketers, the people who target older Oregonians, particularly those Oregonians who are kind of walking the edge between being fully competent in their own affairs and not being fully competent in their own affairs. That law has been on the books for many years. It has been effective, but it suffers from a loophole. And the loophole is simply that although telemarketers are required to register with our office, oddly enough, the legislature didn't provide for revocation authority of that registration once it was granted. So we have had a couple of cases in which we have encountered registered telemarketers who are engaging in violations of Oregon law. We were able to pursue them for those violations of law, but we didn't have independent express statutory authority to revoke the registration. So what this bill does is give the department authority to revoke that registration. I'm not aware of any opposition to the bill, and I'd stand by for questions from the committee.
Thank you. Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify on Senate Bill 380? Okay, with that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 380.
Mr. Chairman, we have five members.
Maybe have five. A work session on Senate Bill 380.
380 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Montgomery moves Senate Bill 380 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Please call the roll. Excuse.
Aye.
Simmons.
Excuse.
Wick.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 380 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Carrier? Representative Rosenbaum? Carry the bill. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 624. Jason, do you want to let us know what we're talking about?
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 624 exempts unaffiliated telecommunications utilities serving fewer than 50,000 access lines from certain regulations. This bill passed unanimously out of the Senate Committee on Business and Consumer Affairs in the Senate.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gary Bauer with the Oregon Telecommunications Association. I'm appearing this afternoon on behalf of the small telecommunications utilities that are members of our association. Quick background on this is in 1987, the Oregon legislature adopted an alternative regulatory process for small telecommunications utilities, and they define those as companies with less than 15,000 access lines. The legislation allowed the companies to petition the commission to receive some relief from regulations over rates, tariffs, transactions, budgets, and issuance of securities. In 1988, following passage of that law, the 18 small companies petitioned the PUC, and the PUC did grant them an exemption. There are two companies that are about to surpass the 15,000 access line limit. As a result, we're seeking introduction, or sought the introduction of this bill, to change the definition from 15 to 50,000. We chose that number because that's part of one of the definitions of a small rural telecommunications carrier under the Federal Telecommunications Act. I might give you a little quick background. It did pass out of the Senate committee unanimously. The PUC had a preference of 30,000. However, the Senate committee chose to keep it at 50,000, and that's the way it came over here to you. I can go through the process if you'd like, or stop at this point.
Questions? Any other questions? Roger, are you okay?
Chair Hill, members of the committee, we would prefer 30,000, but 50,000 affects two small companies, I believe, Malheur Bell and Citizens, and this is all right with us.
Okay.
It's okay.
Thanks. Anyone else like to testify on Senate Bill 624? Hearing seeing none, public hearing on Senate Bill 624, open a work session on Senate Bill 624.
Chairman, I move 624 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Montgomery moves Senate Bill 624 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Please call the roll. Excuse?
Aye.
Excuse?
Aye.
Excuse?
Rosenbaum. Aye.
Excuse?
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 64 moves to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Carrier? Anybody dying to carry? Representative King. Thank you. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 931. Jason, do you want to explain to what we're looking at?
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 931 increases from $10,000 to $100,000 the value of property that a public utility or telecommunications utility may sell or otherwise transfer without obtaining prior approval from the PUC. It also authorizes a public utility or a telecommunications utility to sell or otherwise transfer property valued between $25,000 and $100,000 if written notice is provided to the commission within 60 days following its sale.
Who would like Roger, Brian, and John Gervais? We have three chairs. Bring you all up at once. Who would like to start first?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian Bowe, and I'm here this afternoon representing Portland General Electric. And we're here in support of Senate Bill 931, and we hope the committee will move the bill expeditiously. We feel this is more a housekeeping issue and are not aware of any opposition to the measure. The need for Senate Bill 931 arises from a statute adopted in 1971 when ORS 757-480 and 759-375 were adopted, creating a $10,000 limit on the amount of any property transaction action a utility or telecommunications utility can undertake without PUC approval. That limit has remained in place for the last 28 years without adjustment for either inflation or changing market values of utility property. The value of real estate and other utility assets has appreciated at a much higher rate than inflation over this period. This is particularly true in PGE service territory, as well as other regulated utilities operating under this statute. As a result, virtually all PGE land sales and most other utility asset transactions of our company have become subject to PUC approval. The process of putting together these applications is cumbersome. They require significant time from our regulatory, legal, accounting, and property services staff. Alternately, the Oregon PUC must spend considerable time in reviewing and approving these applications. Consequently, both the utility and the PUC incur costs. Senate Bill 931 requires that a utility notify the PUC of a property transaction in excess of $25,000 but less than $100,000 within 60 days following the sale. Utility property transactions of $100,000 or more require prior approval from the PUC. This increase in dollar limit from $10,000 to $100,000 was necessary for prior approval from the PUC will save both the agency and the utility ratepayer money. This bill was developed in consultation and with the concurrence of the PUC and has their support, and Commissioner Hamilton is here to testify to that.
Welcome.
Chair Hill, members of the committee, thank you. Roger Hamilton, PUC. We think this is a good way to streamline regulation. Provides for no substantial risks to harming customers. If you took what $10 is worth when this was originally implemented at $10,000, it would be worth about $40 now, so $40,000 would be the inflation limit, but we can live with $100,000 with the provision that there's a 60-day review period for those sales. It leaves water utilities alone because this is a pretty big chunk of change for a water utility, which are much smaller. With that, we support the bill and recommend passage.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Gervais, and I'm representing the National Electrical Contractors Association. I'd intended to oppose the bill, but decided that with the PUC's oversight and other activities, that it isn't as onerous as I'd originally seen it to be. It makes a good point, though, in your deliberations on Senate Bill 1149 in terms of power deregulation and the protection of small businesses from cross-subsidy of a major utility to their affiliate company that's in competition with the smaller businesses in the state. Because if they could pass bucket trucks and various other things, office supplies, et cetera, to a affiliate company at a depreciated value, that would be a very serious blow to a competitive situation. I think the PUC is looking at these kinds of things very diligently, and under Senate Bill 1149, as it's now written, that process would continue.
Representative King?
I find the bill supportive, but I do have some concern about batch processing. So a property up to $100,000, I think it makes perfectly sense, but perfectly good sense, but I do have a question about what happens if there's 10 properties. I don't see any limitation there, so in effect that could be a $1 million transaction. That might have some impact on public policy, and I don't see that addressed in the bill. Can you advise me? Number of properties?
Mr. Chairman, Representative King, they still must be submitted if they're in excess of $25,000, simply not for prior approval. But if there were some pattern of activity like you had described, that the PUC would recognize that and take appropriate action. So I believe there is protection.
It is after the fact, so you could sell $1 million where the property technically is.
Mr. Chair, Representative King, technically, but then I believe that the PUC would have recourse in other ways, other authority over the utility to correct any wrong.
Representative King, first remember, these are not affiliate transactions. These are third-party transactions. We will retain our traditional authority over affiliate transactions, but the review period gives us ample opportunity to check on the kind of thing you're talking about, and I wouldn't expect that. I was just looking over a history of property transactions in dockets. It reveals a pattern of much smaller amounts for the most part, and specific occasions I see no aggregation. I could ask Mark, you have any Can you add to this? No.
So these sales are all contingent upon, you know, between $25,000 and $100,000 are all contingent upon the UCB final authority?
Or yes.
Are these completed transactions?
These would require notification prior to completion, as I understand it. They're not completed transactions.
So,
looking at the bill language to make sure that that's the case.
And just to clarify that, so it's my understanding that aggregation is not covered, it's just based on faith.
I do not believe aggregation is specifically covered in the language of the bill. That's correct, Representative King.
Any further questions? Is there anyone else who would like to testify on Senate Bill 931? Hearing seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 931. Open a work session on Senate Bill 931. Representative Witt.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 931 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Witt moves Senate Bill 931 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative King.
As you just heard from my concerns on aggregation, it doesn't seem like it's a problem. If it ever becomes a problem, I think we can deal with it then. Otherwise, I think that, you know, dealing with on good faith in the interim, it would be fine. I will support that.
Further discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Decker.
Excuse.
King.
Aye.
Crummell.
Aye.
Montgomery.
Aye.
Rasmussen.
Excuse.
Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 931 is before the due pass recommendation. Carrier? Representative Witt.
Going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1149. Is Representative Welsh here? And Tom Imeson?
Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Imeson from Pacific Corp. Appreciate the chance to be here today to discuss our views on Senate Bill 1149. Catherine McDowell from the Stoll Reeves law firm, who is an attorney working with us on this legislation and has assisted in drafting our amendments, is here with me today. Provide first a little context on where we're coming from. Pacific Power currently serves over 475,000 retail electric customers in Oregon, or about a third of the state's consumers. While our headquarters are in Portland, most of our customers live in cities, towns, and rural areas outside the Portland metropolitan area. We employ over 2,000 people in the state and have more than 10,000 shareholders in Oregon. We take a lot of pride in our involvement in Oregon with employees who are deeply involved in supporting local activities and company support of projects to maintain healthy and viable Oregon communities. While increased customer choice is good public policy, we need to also remember that many benefits have come to Oregon consumers from our current regulatory system. Our customers enjoy reliable electric service at a low cost, well below national and Western averages. Therefore, any changes to the current regulatory system must be approached with caution. Pacific Corp is unique among Oregon utilities in two respects. First, unlike other power providers in Oregon, Pacific Corp serves retail electric customers in six western states. Second, we own and operate many power generating facilities, providing more than enough power to serve our own customers. In contrast, Portland General Electric and most of Oregon's public utilities must purchase most of their power either from the open wholesale market or from the Bonneville Power Administration. These two circumstances make state deregulation bills more complicated for us and explain why we have much, much more at stake than others when it comes to issues like stranded cost recovery and divestiture or sale of generating plants. Pacific Corp has been an advocate of retail electric competition for at least 3 years and was the sponsor of 1995 legislation that brought performance-based rate making to Oregon. We know restructuring is a complicated issue and that many different groups have much at stake in the ultimate design of the new marketplace. We are especially watchful to the issues that affect our customers and our shareholders. We believe that the bill can be improved in a way that will satisfactorily address our major concerns, and I urge the committee to be open to these improvements. To that end, I have an explanation of our specific amendments attached to my testimony. These amendments focus on three general issues which I would like to discuss with the committee. The first of these is the timing of direct access and the need for an appropriate transition period. In the current environment, the company works with the Public Utility Commission to determine the total cost of providing electric service to customers. These costs are then allocated with PUC review and approval among the various customer groups. In Oregon, we believe, and the PUC has backed this up, that these costs are currently allocated in such a way that residential customers pay less for electricity than what it actually costs to serve them, and industrial and commercial customers pay more. This is called a rate subsidy. Under Senate Bill 1149, these commercial and industrial customers will be allowed to select their energy service provider by October 1, 2001. The question then becomes, what happens to this subsidy, and what is the impact upon residential customers? Our numbers, based upon our last rate proceeding, indicate that the departure of industrial and commercial customers and the resulting elimination of the subsidy they provide would increase residential rates by as much as 10%. When Commissioner Ickes was asked about residential rate shock at last week's hearing by this committee, he responded by saying that one could not assume that rate shock would occur. The 10% increase for residential customers sounds like rate shock to me. By the way, this does not include the effect of the new 3% public purpose charge or the additional low income charge, which are estimated by the Legislative Fiscal Office to have a $42 million annual impact on customers of private utilities. Deregulation legislation usually either eliminates subsidies or clearly institutes them as public policy. Pacific Corp is not arguing to keep these subsidies, but if the legislature wishes to move to deregulation, we believe it should also carefully examine impacts on all customer groups and work where possible to state explicitly how the issue of rate shock should be addressed. There should be no ambiguity on an issue that is this critical to our customers. The amendments we are suggesting would eliminate subsidies but provide a phase-in period to mitigate impacts on residential customers, moving the date when business customers have direct access until January 1, 2003, 15 months beyond the date currently in Senate Bill 1149. Extending the date also helps solve some other timing problems with the bill. As it stands now, the PUC has until May 1, 2001 to determine if direct access would adversely impact residential and small farm customer access to Bonneville Power. If so, the PUC could call the whole thing off. If direct access clears that hurdle, utilities would then have only 5 months before launching direct access, hardly enough time to implement the expensive, time-consuming infrastructure that will be needed. The second issue for Pacific Corp is the elimination of the major inequities in the bill between private and public power. The bill currently includes several inequities in the treatment of private utilities and their customers, who make up roughly 75% of the state, compared to the public utilities and co-ops, which make up about 25%. Ideally, we believe increased choice is something that should be available to all Oregon consumers and that all utilities should be operating from a level playing field. However, we recognize it's not feasible to implement increased choice across the board. A partial approach to competition does create some inequities, however. Because Senate Bill 1149 imposes several transition and public purpose charges onto Pacific Power and PGE customers, but it does not make these changes non-bypassable, some customers will be motivated to avoid these charges by leaving not just the incumbent utility's generation, but by leaving its distribution system as well. Once those customers have left, through municipalization, creation of a co-op, or other means, system costs are shifted to remaining customers. Senate Bill 1149's provision to protect customers from unwarranted cost shifting can't prevent this from occurring. To address these concerns, Pacific Corp suggests that the bill be amended to incorporate the following measures. First, if a public utility or co-op opts in to direct access and a portfolio, it should then live under the same rules as private utilities. They should be required to collect the same public purpose charge and low income charges under the same rules as private utilities. And as an aside, the 3% public purpose charge that is currently part of the bill is significantly higher than what we have actually been paying for renewables, conservation, and low-income assistance in recent years. The actual number is closer to 1%, so the public purpose and low-income charges impose significant new charges for our customers. In addition, public utilities that restrict entry into their new service territory by enacting additional restrictions on competitors should be required themselves to live by these more stringent rules. The third major issue for Pacific Corp is the transition cost issue. A bill that mandates direct access for customers while leaving decisions on stranded costs for another day is unacceptable to us. Virtually every state that has enacted customer choice legislation has included in it a framework for addressing this key transition issue. Unfortunately, Senate Bill 1149 simply grants the PUC the authority to resolve this issue. We propose a more definitive solution. First, these transition costs should be split into two categories, one that we call regulatory assets, and the second, which is stranded generation. Regulatory assets are costs that have been required of us as a regulated business, such as mandated power purchases from independent power producers, deferred conservation costs, deferred pension costs, reclamation costs, decommissioning costs, and deferred income taxes. They result from actions and accounting practices utilities were required to undertake as regulated utilities. They are currently being recovered through rates set by the PUC. Regulatory assets will not be available in a competitive environment and have no value in the marketplace. We believe these costs should remain in rates and propose that utilities continue to collect them in a distribution charge until the costs are fully paid. Our proposal would make these charges, as well as the other transition charges and public purpose charges authorized by this bill, non-bypassable. This provision prevents cost shifting and ensures that all customers pay their fair share of the costs of the new market system. A number of the other states that have dealt with this issue have included anti-bypass provisions in their electric restructuring laws. Anti-bypass provisions are standard in electric restructuring legislation, and the absence of such provisions in Senate Bill 1149 is conspicuous. The second type of stranded cost for generation has created a great deal more uncertainty. There's even disagreement over whether Pacific Corp has stranded generation costs. The reality is that nobody can say with certainty whether regulation will bring higher or lower prices, and it is only when we know these future prices that we will be able to say with any certainty whether current generation is going to be cost competitive and whether Pacific Corp will have stranded costs. So we propose simply to have no stranded cost determination made by the legislature, by the PUC, by ourselves, or by a forced sale of those plants. Instead, Pacific Corp proposes that utilities be permitted to assume full responsibility for their stranded generation costs and that customers pay nothing.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yes, Representative Hill.
Thank you. So are you suggesting that in the language 1149, would allow the Public Utilities Commission to require the sale of assets in Pacific Corp?
1149 encourages or states that the commission should provide incentives for divestiture. I don't think it requires it, but it does enable an administrative determination of stranded costs. Pacific Corp also proposes that all customers be permitted to remain on a cost of service rate. So if a customer chooses direct access and makes some part of Pacific Corp's current generation surplus, then Pacific Corp proposes that the surplus portion of its generation, that is, the part no longer needed to serve cost of service customers, be deregulated through a PUC proceeding designed to balance the interests of remaining cost of service customers and utility shareholders. We will assume the risk that our generating plants will not be stranded as they become deregulated, or we will work to reduce their operating costs to make them price competitive. We believe this proposal is fair and symmetrical because customers who believe that Pacific Corp has below market generation or stranded benefits are free to continue enjoying below market rates indefinitely through Pacific Corp's cost of service rate. They can stay with the system. On the other hand, customers who believe that Pacific Corp's generation is above market, that is, we would have stranded costs, are free to choose direct access without having to pay for those stranded costs. What this proposal prevents is the inconsistency and unfairness of a customer choosing direct access because it believes Pacific Corp's rates are above market, but then arguing that it is entitled to a credit for stranded benefits because Specific Corp's costs are below market. In conclusion, with these changes, we believe we'll be able to get to a bill that is fair to our company and to our customers, industrial, commercial, and residential. We stand ready to work with the committee in furtherance of these objectives. Thank you, and we'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you. Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, I think your last paragraph, you talk about trying to get to a system in terms of where a user could not request a credit because they believe you have stranded benefits.
Right.
And, do you believe in terms of the way 1149 is drafted today that the commission could direct you to pay someone who is no longer on your system, you know, a credit based upon benefits?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, yes, we believe that the way the legislation is currently drafted, it could not only do this, but do this based not on the sale of any property, but based on an administrative determination on studies about whether these generating assets are above market or not. And if they felt that there were benefits for customers, that they could come back and charge those, or we would have to pay that to the customers.
Representative King?
I have a few. Did you discuss any amendments while the bill was over on the Senate side?
Mr. Chair, Representative King, we did discuss potential amendments with the chairman of the committee and the sponsor of the bill, and we're advised that we should take our amendments to the House. We did take in conceptual amendments that we had to the legislation. They are not all respects identical to the ones today because the bill has moved some, but they are consistent with what we're proposing today.
On the second page of your testimony, when you discuss a partial approach to competition, And I didn't see this kind of a stranded cost either in terms when you defined the different types of costs, the generational or the regulatory. But aren't there some stranded costs associated with like an industrial user for, you know, for their distribution? So for me to give you a certain price, you know, in a contract for power over a period of time that I might be, you know, installing some hardware there to be able to provide that level of service in the way that you want that. And it seems like that kind of a stranded cost wasn't included in your discussion and could get lost if you're saying there should be no stranded cost recovery.
Chairman Hill, Representative King.
It's my understanding that Representative Witt is chairing the meeting.
Excuse me. Off to a great start here. Chairman Witt, Representative King, for the record, I'm Catherine McDowell, attorney for Pacific Corp, attorney at Stoll Reeves. I think that the kind of costs you're talking about are probably distribution costs. If just based on your description of the costs, they'd be costs designed to help provide service to customers. Those are traditionally viewed as distribution costs, and those costs would remain a part of the distribution charges that customers would pay in a future, even deregulated market. People would continue to pay the distribution company for their distribution charges. Does that answer your question?
Well, let me clarify.
Maybe I didn't understand your question.
I think you do understand it, and you may have given, you know, the correct answer, but I'd like to
okay.
put it just a little further, that if I'm that user and I set the hardware and I set up a price with you for the power, and then I go and I buy my power someplace else, now I'm not buying power from you, I'm only getting distribution from you, are you saying that I'm going to be paying a higher price to you for my distribution service than someone else who didn't have special investments related to the delivery of their power under the previous rates that they were paying?
Chairman Witt, Representative King, typically customers such as you describe who have special costs and needs associated with their distribution service, often they're provided service under a contract. And as I understand the provisions of the bill says contract provisions will remain intact notwithstanding the bill. So I guess my sense is the way the PUC would handle that is that those customers would continue to pay those charges in their distribution rate. So they would pay a larger distribution fee than other customers, reflecting the special needs for their distribution service, which is another way of saying that I don't believe that distribution-related costs in that situation would be stranded costs. I think that the kinds of stranded costs you would see associated with distribution services are potentially the kind of costs that are associated with ramping up for direct access.
So I guess I could check with the PUC a little farther to find out if there were, you know, if it's very significant that that a utility might have been doing investment based on speculation or faith as versus only contract.
I think that's Representative, or Chairman Witt, Representative King, I think that's right. I mean, we, in our looking at that, we would assume that those charges would be captured in a future distribution charge.
I have a couple more, but you can go ahead.
Why don't you go ahead and finish up, Representative King.
Mr. Imeson, it sounded, and this has had some I hadn't caught before, and maybe just some explanation might be helpful. When you had addressed stranded costs, are you indicating that the PUC will not have any authority over stranded costs in a post-dereg environment with the deregulated utility?
The way we've, Mr. Chair, Representative King, what we have proposed is that when you move into that environment, if a customer chooses to leave the system, then in terms of that customer, the deregulated portion of it, that there would not be a stranded cost charge assessed against that customer, and neither would there be a stranded benefit charge assessed against the utility.
Okay. One last one. Thank you, anyway.
Representative King.
I keep looking to see if there's any flexibility of enrollment in this, but it keeps looking like there's a magic day, a magic deadline, and you're in or you're out, and I wonder about flexibility of subsequent enrollments, both for the initial selection, but then also in terms of a secondary market, so that, let's say I own a business and I was aggregated and, you know, I want to sell my business, and they want to belong to a different association, and they need to do something different, or they weren't in, and I wish it was. Can you address flexibility or inflexibility of enrollment by the customer?
Yeah, I think that my colleague here can address that.
Chairman Witt, Representative King. Actually, I think our amendments provide greater flexibility for customers than the present bill does, because our amendments permit everyone to stay on a cost of service rate if they so choose. The current bill offers direct access and does not require the continuing provision of the cost of service rate to industrial customers, to large customers. And we have certainly heard from our customers, including some of our biggest customers, that they would like the choice to stay, really maintain the status quo. And it was really responding to that, and frankly responding to many of our other customer groups. The residential customers have expressed no interest in that, and the bill currently reflects their lack of interest in moving forward with this. So I think our amendments are designed, frankly, to give some more flexibility. If people want to stay with the current system, this bill permits them to do it. It also, our amendments would permit them to do it, but it also permits the larger customers, if they choose to go to market, to be able to do that as well. The one thing our amendments do is say that if you choose to go to market, you can't come back and then be paid for the privilege of getting to choose a different supplier.
Representative Bill?
Thank you, Mr. Currently today on your books, you carry some charges you're going to recoup. You calculated out that over a certain period of time, you're going to get your return on your investment. So are you suggesting in terms that you're willing to on a date certain sort of eat that in terms of so that you'll take, if it's a loss, it's a loss. If it's a gain, it's a gain to you. But that the rate payers will, after a date certain, you won't say, well, you still owe me for this back over here. I may be depreciating this asset over 20 years. I'm going to take all the depreciation, have to eat that, and you're not going to be able to recover that in your rates. Is that what you're suggesting in terms of how to balance out, where if you have benefits, you take benefits. If you have losses, you take losses. And
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, what we're proposing goes to those customers who leave the system. With respect to the rest of the regulated system, it would be handled in a manner similar to the way it's handled today when you do look at depreciation and investment and those kinds of things. But we are willing to say that for those customers who choose to leave the system, go to direct access, we would be left with whatever risk is implied with that, any responsibility for that. On the other hand, any benefit related to that as well.
Well, under what kind of system, in terms of, would you be able to calculate so that you don't, so that if it's a loss, those losses don't then roll back on to those who choose not to leave, so that it's equal. So in terms of if they want to stay in the status quo and continue in a regulated rate situation where you as a company are guaranteed a return on your investment over time, how do you set that up so that as those who leave are calculated today, there's an assumption that they're going to pay a certain portion of that return, that return doesn't then roll back on to remaining customers?
I think.
Chairman Witt, Representative Hill, that is an excellent question, and that is a question that we struggle with in trying to put together this proposal, both that the partial deregulation of assets not hurt cost of service customers, but it also not hurt shareholders. There's got to be a balance there in how you deregulate the generation. Obviously, from a cost of service customer's perspective, you wouldn't want to deregulate all the good stuff. And from the utility shareholder's perspective, you wouldn't want to deregulate all the dogs. I mean, that's just, to put it bluntly, that's how you wouldn't want that result from either perspective. So our amendment includes language that requires the PUC to develop a process to do this deregulation in a manner that guarantees that there's a balance between those interests so that the deregulation doesn't result in basically a harm or benefit to either side, that it through the PUC proceeding, you would manage to protect the interests of the cost of service ratepayers as well as the shareholders. You'd basically do it on an average cost basis. You'd look at the average cost of your generation, the system, and then you'd deregulate on that basis. It would be, a technical accounting type proceeding that would occur at the PUC, but one in which this legislature would give guidelines to the PUC to do it in a manner that balances those competing interests.
Representative Hill.
Is there a mechanism in terms of where instead of giving broad authority off to the PUC that we as the legislature at least get to play a little bit in this understanding in terms of stranded costs? I mean, I don't know. I'm trying to understand the relationship between continuing forward on a date certain for choice and if the commission then has a responsibility to come back to the legislature, and then, I mean, in the 71st legislature, that would be the appropriate time to debate how to deal with stranded costs or stranded benefits versus trying to sort of punt everything out of here in this thing, and then we can all come back, or we're I mean, it just seems to me otherwise that you'll be in court, you'll be back here, and then we'll have the same arguments about how we're overturning court cases, you know, and depending on, you know, if the commission wants you to overturn it or not overturn it, it'll depend in terms of whether they support it or not, so we could be in a big mess. So.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, the amendments that we proposed really try to work within the framework of Senate Bill 1149, which does not contemplate doing that. I think if the committee or if the legislature wanted to take that path, you would probably do something more similar to the what's been referred to loosely as the UE 102 legislation, where you actually go through the proceedings, the regulatory proceedings first, and then the legislature has an opportunity to take a look at that and decide whether if that's the right path or not.
Mr. Emerson, what do you think would, if the bill goes forward the way it's currently written and becomes law, what do you think would, in general, happen to industrial and commercial rates?
Well, Mr. Chair, we believe, as I said right now, that industrial and commercial customers pay a subsidy that flows to residential customers. Absent that subsidy, even within our regulated system, their rates would decline. And I think that with the bill, their opportunity to get rates that are at least at that level is probably fairly clear. I assume that's one of the reasons that a number of them want to have the opportunity. So I think they would see, one thing, as I said, about deregulation is that it deals with subsidies in a pretty clear manner. They are eliminated, or unless there's a special provision for them, there's a mechanism to continue them. Absent that, which is absent in this bill, I think that they would see lower prices for power than they currently do.
What would your company do to try to retain those customers?
Mr. Chair, we would, we have worked in some instances to retain customers now with special contracts but those require PUC approval, and if they cannot demonstrate that but for that contract it would have a serious economic impact on their company, we can't do that. We would continue, we are involved in a number of efforts right now to reduce our costs. We're going to continue on that path no matter what we do. We believe that this is going to happen, that industrial customers in particular will get choice, and in some respects they have it now. So we'd continue on that path of trying to manage our costs pretty aggressively. There are really two separate issues, and one of them is the subsidy issue, and the other is just the cost of providing the service.
And the portfolio option that is provided for in the bill, have you, from the pilot studies that were done or from any work that PacifiCorp has done, do you have any insight as to how consumers will break out among those portfolio options and what the impact of that will be on rates?
Mr. Chair, it's hard to extrapolate too much from one pilot project. We did have a portfolio project in Klamath County, and you learn a fair amount about how to market it to your customers, how many of them respond to the green rates that are part of that. We actually think the portfolio approach is a pretty sensible way to go for dealing with residential customers because it provides them some framework of choice within the current regulated environment. But it's also, I think, as we've looked at other experiences around the country, there hasn't been a lot of marketing for residential customers, and I think generally they have not been real beneficiaries of deregulation themselves. So I think the portfolio approach is one way of dealing with that.
Do you have any sense as to how residential customers, what they would choose and what percentages among those portfolio choices?
Mr. Chair, my recollection from our Klamath project is that we had several options that were available to residential customers. They essentially voted their choices. The options included a market rate, included a green power rate, and community-based rate, where a certain amount would go back for projects in the community. Of those who opted to go into the portfolio at all, the green power rate seemed to be one that was pretty attractive to people.
Do you know what was the impact of that rate? Did it raise their prices?
Mr. Chair, yes, it was a slight increase in prices.
If we can go back to this rate shock concern that you've expressed, I believe you indicated that you believe that if this bill goes forward in the way it was drafted and the timing that it provides for, that your company could justify a rate increase of up to 10% for residential customers?
Mr. Chair, it's a matter of eliminating that subsidy. If the commercial industrial customers were to leave, that's how much the transfer of that subsidy would be. Several years ago, I think 3 years ago, in the Oregon Public Utility Commission's last rate case, our industrial customers proposed phasing out that subsidy in a five-year period at that time. I think because, I don't want to speak for them, but I think they were concerned about impacts of a transfer more rapidly than a five-year period. We reduced that some, but if you were to do it rapidly, and if those customers were to depart, and some of this is, it's hard to know precisely what they would be until you're actually in the circumstances. That's why we think the subsidies ought to be phased out prior to moving to direct access, but it could have an impact of that magnitude.
Is the estimated 10%, is that based upon all commercial customers leaving?
I do. If you want to get into the rate side of it, I do have somebody here who could probably come up and add a few words about that on how we put together the math on that, if you'd like. Andrea Kelly is here from Pacific Works.
Yeah, that would be good. I think this is something the committee is interested in, is the potential impact here on residential customers. So.
Chairman Witt, my name is Andrea Kelly for the record. The 10% does assume that the rate subsidy is completely eliminated between customer classes. And I think it goes to the language in the bill that talks about unwarranted cost shift. And I think there's a question in people's minds about what that could mean different things to different people. And we would like some clarity on whether the subsidy should persist after deregulation or not. It seems like the general acknowledgement of the commission and industrial customers over time is that these need to be eliminated before we go to direct access, and we're responding to the positions that have been taken.
Representative Hill.
Thank you. In Section 19 of the ingress bill, it allows the public commission to require an electric company to enter into a contract with Bonneville Power Administration. Since it's my understanding, Pacific Corps has ventured down a path of investing in building generation facilities to serve its own load, in terms of what is the effect of that on rates to customers? First question is, are Bonneville Power rates today above or below market? So the committee understands where we're starting today at.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, as to whether they're above or below market, they really help set the market, Bonneville rates do right now. I think in terms of how the bill would work, and what our responsibilities would be, our concerns in the past, and I'd like Ms. McDowell to speak to that, our concerns in the past have been, if there was a requirement placed on the company to purchase Bonneville Power on behalf of a certain customer group, and that turns out to be a bad decision, we would like to be
we would like the risk of that bad decision to be something that is recognized by decisions made by the commission in requiring us to do that. It's not a matter of us being opposed to some power acquisition on behalf of residential or farm customers from Bonneville. We have they have benefited in the past through an exchange program that was authorized by the 1980 Act of Congress. But I think Catherine could probably talk a little bit about how this bill would work, which is a little different than the last bill that was considered a couple of years ago.
Chairman Witt, Representative Hill, I'm not sure how much of your question remains unanswered, but if the question is this a new provision, the requirement that the company, or the, I guess, giving the commission authority to require the company to purchase Bonneville power, I would say that that is a new provision. That does give the PUC new authority. We certainly have had the authority in the past to send a strong suggestions that this would be a good thing for us to do, and if we ignore those suggestions, that we would hear about it in the next rate proceeding. So in some sense, they've had some ability to influence those purchases. But I think the company historically has retained the ultimate discretion to choose what it purchases and then bear some responsibility for whether that's a prudent decision or not, because this changes that compact that the commission would require the company to make those purchases. The bill does include language that says that the company should recover its uneconomic costs associated with Bonneville power purchases, which suggests, I think, what is obvious here, that nobody knows whether which way the market's going to go, whether that those would be good purchases or bad, but that if the company is required to purchase them, that it's fair to permit the company to recover the costs associated with them if they choose to be turn out to be poor purchases. The problem with that language, and one of our amendments goes to this, is that the bill also defines uneconomic costs as costs incurred prior to the date of the act. So the language currently in the Bonneville section, which permits companies to recover uneconomic costs associated with BPA purchases, actually I think is it could at least arguably become ineffective because of the definition of uneconomic costs, which cuts off after the date, the effective date of the act. I mean, this is we certainly made the arguments on the Senate side that we should do this a little more slowly to make sure that the bill was internally consistent. And I think this is one of the internal inconsistencies that we've tried to correct in our amendments.
Representative Hill?
Wouldn't one of the other effects would be that if you are required to purchase power and you don't need the power, then you would have extra power at your facilities. And rates today, I'm assuming, are based upon the fact that you're going to get a return on selling that power or delivering that to your generation facilities. So therefore, there'll be an imbalance, and who will pay the difference if market conditions are that you can't sell your excess power, but yet you're required to purchase Bonneville? My assumption is that rates go up to do that, and then that's then borne by those who are left on the system, a.k.a. residential customers.
Chairman Witt, Representative Hill, I think that is the effect of the provision that permits the companies to recover uneconomic costs associated with the Bonneville power purchases. So the scenario you just played out is one where the company would incur costs as a result of those purchases, and the bill, the way that section reads, the companies would be permitted to recover their costs associated with those purchases if they turn out to be a bad idea. And obviously the group from whom those costs would be recovered are the people who are left on the system. I think it's probably the most obvious group that would pay for that, because they would be the people receiving the cost of service rate, which would be where the Bonneville power is going.
So the antithesis of that is, in terms of if there was a robust market for electricity and you had to buy it, then the benefits would roll in.
Customers would receive a lower rate in the form of a lower cost of service rate.
In terms of your proposal on stranded costs, specifically for generation, do I understand you correctly to be saying that what Pacific Corp wants to do is they want to be able to compete in the direct access game on a competitive basis with those who can purchase power competitively, commercial and industrial customers.
Chairman Witt, I would not put it that way. The company is going to be required to continue to provide a cost of service rate to its residential customers, and under the current bill, the PUC could require it to provide a cost of service rate to all customers. So the way the bill is currently evolved, the bill contemplates that incumbent utilities continue to provide cost of service rates to its customers. And that's basically what we are saying, is that if customers want to stay on their incumbent utility's cost of service rate, then they should be permitted to do so. If they want to leave and go buy their commodity from somebody else, then they can do that. Now, I'm saying that it's not, in some ways, that I guess ends up that the company competes with ESPs who want to come in and provide commodity to those customers, but it's not that Pacific Corp is setting up a marketer who will be competing with those ESPs for that commodity. It's really, you know, it's basically for people who want a bundled, regulated cost of service rate, the company will provide that. That's not what ESPs, what new energy service providers are going to be offering.
Right.
So in some words, it's not apples and apples. It's a different commodity, a different service that the company would be proposing to provide.
And then let me read this line in Ms. Brimason's testimony maybe and give me an explanation of it. If a customer chooses direct access and makes some part of Pacific Corp's current generation surplus, then Pacific Corp proposes that the surplus portion of its generation be deregulated through a PUC proceeding that is designed to balance the interests of remaining cost of service customers and utility shareholders.
Chairman Witt, it is true that a portion of, under our proposal, a portion of the company's load would become surplus. I mean, it would become surplus. That's what's going to happen under direct access when people leave the load. We just propose that that surplus load be deregulated. And there's a whole other question about what the company does with that deregulated load. It could sell it into the wholesale market, in which case it would be doing nothing other than what it currently does with its surplus generation, except that the profits and losses connected with that sale would be treated differently. If it wanted to compete directly with energy service suppliers, the PUC has made its position quite clear in this state that Pacific Corp would not be able to do it as a regulated company. It would have to set up an unregulated affiliate that would be governed by a series of fairness rules, so as to prevent the kind of unfair competition that I think your question is talking about. So, you know, I don't see it as an anti-competitive measure in that respect, because if Pacific Corp wants to play in that market, then the PUC would regulate, would set up rules, fairness rules, that would prohibit Pacific Corp from being able to unfairly take advantage of its incumbent utility status in the state.
To the extent that that power is deregulated, I assume that your amendment would say that losses in the sale of your deregulated power could not be carried over to raise your cost of service rate, correct?
Mr. Chair, that's the most of the point of that language, absolutely. It severs that tie either way.
Representative Witt, in fact, if you believe that the company has stranded costs, the deregulation of those assets would actually be quite advantageous to utility customers, because otherwise, if those costs remain in the system, they will raise the cost of service of customers who stay on the utility's cost of service rate.
Okay. Are there other questions? Anything else that you'd like to add?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Well, why don't you go get them? We probably should get them. We'll just hand these to them. Okay, Tom Cropper.
Hi. My name is Tom Cropper. I'm from Portland. Honorable members of the committee, Chair Jim Hill. I'm opposing this bill. Frankly, I don't understand what the benefit is going to be to residential customers. I have a videotape program that was taped at the Eastside Democratic Club, and somebody from the Fair and Clean Coalition was promoting a version of this bill. Members of the club don't think that residential customers will benefit. I want to note that Article 11B in the state constitution was passed November 8, 1932. That was the first year that Franklin Delano Roosevelt was elected president. By an initiative, Measure 13, a state power development was authorized, but it was never implemented. It's said in Section 2, to control or develop, the state will control or develop the water power within the state, and to develop in conjunction with the United States government and local government. It doesn't mention private companies at all. To loan and issue debt to the amount of 1.5% of the true cash value of all property in the state, taxed on an ad valorem basis. This was passed. It's still part of the Constitution. It specifically mentions hydroelectric power. I remember that the last legislature 2 years ago transferred the public right to hydroelectric power to the private utilities without any payment. And this is an issue that Lloyd Marbet, Dan Meek, and others have objected to. I don't say that we're going to get any benefit out of this. What I do see is a market in energy futures. And we already have a network grid where companies can trade power back and forth. So, anyway, that's my statement. Thank you. I'm turning this tape over to you. 1 hour. It plays in Portland this week.
Okay. Mr. Cropper, do you want to see if there's any questions? Are there any questions for Mr. Cropper? Okay, thank you, Mr. Cropper. Representative Welsh, you're just in time. Welcome.
Thank you. Fortunately, we just finished our committee, so it's perfect time. I appreciate that. Mr. Chair, committee members, I know you're discussing Senate Bill 1149, and after we worked so hard on power deregulation issue last session, put together a piece of legislation that has, and I have read Senate Bill 1149, a lot of the provisions and components of that legislation. You've already been introduced to us, so I'm not going over section after section of that. I just want to let you know that I believe that we should move on this legislation. take your time to listen to certainly the stakeholders that have been working on this, and they were working and communicating even during the interim. So they have taken measured consideration of all the components of this legislation, I know. But as I read it, I also understood that there was a lot of still regulatory control over this issue. I don't think that's a negative aspect. I think it is positive, because certainly in the state of Oregon, many people will say, well, why should Oregon move into deregulation as being on average, a low-rate state? And it is strictly an average. There's disparities between service territories within the state that are fairly large. That's what brought us to the discussion in 1997, and before that, certainly. But what has happened across the nation, and with FERC, and the 1992 Dereg Act at the federal level, it is something that we should prepare for, and we certainly try to draw and design, establish what is important for Oregon to take the first step. We have plenty within this Senate Bill 1149 in control and regulation, the first step. We'll address 80% of the state, that being under the direct service of our investor-owned utilities, with an opportunity certainly for the consumer-owned utilities to opt out. And I think that's important. But then measures in this legislation, as I read, that would allow them to opt in after a period of time, after their local governing boards to make some decisions, if they so choose. And I think that is very Oregon. And I think it's important that after we sign EDI by the second week of June this year, I can't believe that. Anyway, when we sign EDI, I think our rate payers out there, our customers, whether they're at the industrial, commercial, or residential level, they will know there is still regulation designed in this legislation to protect them. Some of us that would like to see market considerations and forces, honestly, why I got into deregulation, I would see more of that in this industry. But in Oregon, I think our first step within this legislation will get us there in a very incremental and measured way. I don't think that's bad. I don't think that's bad at all. So I just wanted to let you know that as someone that has spent a lot of time on this issue, and I still, every chance I get, try to read as much as I can about this issue, because it intrigues me. Great industry. I think the provisions within this bill, yes, there will be some that you want to discuss a little harder than others, and maybe some of the stakeholders have more to say about some issues in here. I wish I was serving with you on this committee on this issue, but I've got other responsibilities. With that, I will close. Good questions.
Yeah, Representative Vigneur, by and large, you see this bill as a positive step forward.
Yes, I do.
If you had to quickly compare it with the legislation you were working with 2 years ago, how would you contrast it?
Well, I think this legislation certainly is not as, in some aspects, not as comprehensive as that legislation. And when you look at it in just the thickness of the paperwork, you see that too. And they're trying to, I think that we were trying to, even back then, draw a distinction in between our investor-owned utilities and our municipals and certainly our consumer-owned utilities, and see where they fit in to deregulation. And certainly the transitional aspect of moving from a regulated environment to a deregulated environment. And that takes time. And I think what they have done is give it more time, okay? And certainly I know that the PUC is there as soon as we sign EDI. They're there to make some, and they can make quicker decisions. And that within the investor-owned utility territories where they have authority. Whereas we can't because we don't come back until 2001. And I don't think that's bad. So we allow investor-owned utilities to opt in, and we didn't have those measures in the other bill either. So they can come in if they make a decision. So I think that's very positive. We did not have the portfolio opportunity. I see this as a piece of legislation that does provide opportunity, certainly more opportunity than we have today. As a residential customer, I would enjoy that because I could take a look at that if my consumer-owned utility decided to opt in to competition. And they're a very progressive consumer-owned utility. They're a co-op. But I live in Lane County, probably the most progressive territory, where you have PUDs, cooperatives, municipalities. They're very progressive. They do not find, I think, it offensive or very negative to consider this, even this session. So I'm not going to speak for them, but I think that as hard as they played last session and during the interim, I think they see the opportunities with this legislation. I hope it'll take us the next 2 years.
Any questions for Representative Welsh? Representative, we appreciate your hard work on this 2 years ago and certainly appreciate your input on this today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Steve Waddington.
Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify on SB 1149. My name is Steve Waddington. I'm the power manager for Reynolds Metals Company. With me today on my left is Kent Moore, the plant manager at Troutdale. On my right is Josephine Myers. She represents the workers of 7 craft unions. And to my far right, Gary Beck, who is president of the local steelworkers union. Reynolds operates an aluminum plant in Troutdale, Oregon. We currently employ 525 people in family wage jobs and have the potential to employ 750 once the plant returns to full capacity. The Troutdale plant has been in operation since 1946 and has been vital to the prosperity of Troutdale and surrounding communities. Over 2,000 Reynolds employees, retirees, and their families are Oregonians. Producing primary aluminum is electricity intensive. Electricity is, in fact, an essential ingredient, like a feedstock, in the electrolytic process by which aluminum is made. Our cost of electricity is about one-third of the production cost of our product. Over our 53-year history in Oregon, Reynolds has always purchased its power directly from the Bonneville Power Administration. Our status as a so-called direct service industry, or DSI, is defined in federal law. Accordingly, the Troutdale plant is connected to the federal system at high voltage. We have never been connected to or served by a distribution utility. Reynolds supports the major purpose of this bill, which is to restructure the operation of distribution utilities to allow their consumers more choice. However, we are very concerned with the impact of the public purpose tax. As the bill is drafted, this public purpose charge would apply to Reynolds with an annual impact of $1.5 million. This would be a major new expense at a plant that is struggling to maintain its competitiveness. It would effectively increase our production costs by about 1%, a cost that we cannot pass on because the price for our product is determined in an intensely competitive worldwide commodity market. Moreover, as the bill is structured, Reynolds would pay the 3% public purpose tax, while Northwest Aluminum would not. Northwest Aluminum is located in the Dalles. It is the only other aluminum plant in Oregon and a direct competitor of Reynolds. We must strenuously object to the proposal to apply this tax to Reynolds' Troutdale plant, while the other aluminum plant in Oregon is exempt. This is a question of simple fairness. But don't take this to mean we are advocating that Northwest Aluminum should pay the 3% tax. That would only jeopardize more aluminum jobs in Oregon. There are 10 aluminum smelters in the Pacific Northwest. Like Reynolds, all of these plants are DSIs, connected to the BPA system at high voltage, and are not customers of distribution utilities. The state of Montana has already passed restructuring legislation, and their one aluminum plant pays no significant tax under their new law. Washington State is yet to restructure, but it appears to me that any legislation that would pass in Olympia will likely exempt the state's 7 aluminum plants. No other smelter anywhere in the world pays an electricity consumption tax. Thus, under this bill, Reynolds Troutdale plant could become the only aluminum smelter in the world forced to pay a 3% tax on its electricity consumption. Before I propose a solution, which I would like to propose today, I need to point out another major challenge facing Reynolds, because it's painfully clear to me that Reynolds, Northwest Aluminum, and other DSIs in Oregon have unique challenges and are not comparable to industries served by the distribution utilities in the state. Notwithstanding that Reynolds has purchased all of its power from BPA for nearly 60 years, Bonneville has proposed a reallocation of its power that would force Reynolds and other DSIs to buy all or most of their electricity from other suppliers. As much as we would like to remain with our traditional supplier, BPA, Reynolds will have no choice but to purchase from other sources and likely at very much at higher cost. Meanwhile, under this bill, Reynolds would also face a new 3% tax at the same time that we are being forced to scramble to survive in a higher cost and volatile energy market. There is a simple, fair solution. Exempt the DSIs, the direct service industries, from the public purpose tax. There are only 4 DSI industries operating in Oregon. None have direct competitors in the state that are not also DSIs, the 2 aluminum plants. Exempting the DSIs will solve the equity issue between the 2 aluminum plants without disrupting the other, more central objectives of this bill. This exemption makes good public policy sense for a number of reasons, and I will list 4. First, the DSI loads have never been connected to the distribution systems that are being restructured by this bill. Second, the DSIs do not benefit from this bill, whereas other industries facing the public purpose charge will stand to benefit from the restructuring of their distribution utility. Third, for a DSI, this tax represents a new cost that will not be offset by lower rates for power. Finally, an exemption for the DSIs will not significantly reduce the revenues and intended program funding for public purposes. You may hear the argument that exempting DSIs from the public purpose tax is unfair, that all industries should be treated the same. I urge you to recognize that industry in Oregon face different circumstances and challenges. The policy objective must be to strike a balance of fairness among industry while recognizing that these differences will continue to exist. For example, industries served by the 36 public utilities in Oregon will continue to enjoy the access of low-cost federal power because these utilities have first preference to this power. These public utility systems are exempt from this restructuring bill, and many of these utilities will have very little incentive to move on their own towards open access and thus impose public purpose taxes on their industrial customers. On the other hand, industries in the two largest investor-owned utility service territories will have the choice of staying with their traditional supplier or shopping in the open market. Either way, these industries will see an offset to the public purpose tax, either in lower regulated rates or in the benefits from open access. Finally, there are the DSIs, which have historically benefited from being supplied directly by BPA, but are now being forced into more expensive markets for their electric supply. Since they have never been and will not become a customer of any distribution utility, they should not get caught in the web of paying public purpose taxes merely because of their geographic location. In closing, addressing the DSIs in a fair and balanced way is critically important because these industries are electric intensive and face highly competitive markets for their products. I urge you to exempt the DSIs from the public purpose tax. With this one amendment, Reynolds would commit wholeheartedly to supporting passage of this bill. Thank you again for the opportunity to share the concerns of Reynolds Metals Company, and I would be happy to try to answer any questions.
Chair. Representative Simmons. Is there an amendment drafted?
Mr. Chair and Representative Simmons, no, we do not have an amendment drafted, but I believe under the structure of the bill it would be very easy to achieve because the only place in this bill that the DSIs are addressed or affected is the public purpose tax, and there is a subparagraph that could be stricken at the end of Section 3 that would solve our issue. And we could provide that to you quickly, but we don't have the amendment drafted.
Other questions? Representative King?
Can you give me a ballpark estimate of how much power your plant consumes compared to the power that's used in the state of Oregon? Are you like 5% of the state's load or 10%? I know it's a significant one.
Mr. Chair, Representative King, I don't have that statistic on the top of my head. I'm pretty sure the largest electric consumer in the state. I could get that statistic for you. I apologize, I don't have it.
I think the committee would appreciate it.
I can do that.
I know that the aluminum industry came to the Pacific Northwest because of low power. That power is the main cost item, so the bauxite comes to us. I was wondering where the cheapest power in the world is today, and does this change in the foreseeable future?
Mr. Chair and Representative King, the statistic I recall on the top of my head is that the average cost of electricity worldwide that's purchased by aluminum smelters is about 20% less than the current BPA rate, which is about 22 mils, so I guess 18 mills roughly is the average rate that aluminum smelters pay for power worldwide.
So you could go elsewhere and get cheaper power in the long run, maybe not tomorrow, but in the long run, that would be possible in the world's market today.
Well, a company like Reynolds will have opportunities to build smelters elsewhere, but I'm here to represent to you that we want to keep these two plants in Oregon and Washington, the two plants we have in the region, operating and keep the employees that we have here working.
Representative King.
Why is the Troutdale plant struggling to be competitive?
You want to answer?
I think she wanted that one.
Okay.
I'm going to try to do this right. Chair Wood, Representative King. I think what I'd like to explain to you.
For the record,
introduce yourself.
I'm sorry. My name is Josephine Myron. I'm a chemist at the laboratory there at Reynolds, and I represent the crafts, some of the unions that are outside the steelworker union here. Something that I like to explain about us surviving is aluminum is not controlled on the world market like gold and silver and tin. So when the Russian country, as we know it, collapsed, their cash was aluminum and vodka, and they beat us up pretty good in 91, and 700 of us got our walking papers in 91. And we walked away from union wages and went back to about $10 an hour. and our wages still haven't kept up with the prices of things are, but we've catered and we've paved over good farmland out there in East County for $8 an hour jobs. And we've given those people tax breaks, and we're trying to build schools now for those people that are employed for $10 an hour, right? And we're just trying to survive in a world, you know, these are good paying union jobs. And we're trying to buy those $100 tennis shoes and $150 aluminum bats for our kids. And when you go out and try to find a job today that's not union, that's not in the aluminum industry, you know, they're not paying the same. Even with that bachelor's degree in chemistry, they're not paying the kind of wages that Reynolds is trying to pay out there. And if you look at the guys that got laid off in 91 and their gray hair, where they've been in the last 6 years now that we're just back trying to make aluminum here in the Northwest, I mean, we're just, you know, we're trying to survive, and we're making aluminum car wheels and aluminum foil in a market where aluminum right now is 50 cents a pound, and it takes us 70 cents a pound to make it. And we're trying to do a better job, you know, and be more cost-effective out there. And the $1.5 million tax at Troutdale, when the Dallas doesn't have it and the Washington plants don't have it, how can we absorb that? Thank you.
Other questions?
Well, I wanted to say why. And in part, I asked a question because, and I appreciate what you're saying in terms of the, you know, post-Soviet Union period. I was also wondering, you know, if that's also a function of investing or not investing, or how the plants kept up as the technology moved along.
Representative Witt and Chairman Witt, Representative King. Obviously, there are a number of things that make a plant competitive.
Could you introduce yourself for the record?
Sorry, Kent Moore. There are a number of things that make a plant competitive. Our technology is old, and we have good workers, and but for us to compete against newer plants with lower cost power is difficult.
To follow that, are you saying those newer plants are offshore, or they're elsewhere, or they're in the Northwest, or?
Most of the new plants are in Canada or offshore, yes.
We don't have to go into Canadian subsidies if you prefer not to.
Thank you.
Other questions?
I'd like to address the chair, please.
Okay.
My name is Gary Beck, Mr. Chair. I'm the United Steelworker Local 330 President. I have transferred from a plant of Reynolds Metals Company in Arkansas in 1983. I have went through plant shutdowns and plant closures due to powers and economics, power prices, consumer prices. And I just want to go on the record that there's a lot of lives that are going to be disrupted or could possibly be disrupted by this bill. And we would like to go on record to ask you to turn this bill down.
A question I have that any of you could feel free to answer. The bill allows you to self-direct public purpose charges to use it internally in your facility for enhanced conservation, so forth. Is that feasible in the case of Reynolds, and if so, to what extent?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm aware of that provision in the bill, and we have looked at that carefully, and there may, from time to time, be some ability for us to take advantage of that. But our conclusion has been that unless Reynolds decides to make a very major capital improvement project at the plant, which they may or may not do, but unless they make that decision, the amount of self-directed conservation that we could get credit for appears to us to be pretty small.
Anybody else like to comment on that? Okay. Representative King.
I have a question to follow up. If someone else had a comment on that, I didn't want to interrupt.
Okay, and is there anybody else who wants to comment on that? If not, we'll go to Representative King.
Mr. Beck, I think you said at the end of your testimony that you opposed the bill. My understanding from Mr. Waddington is that you really were referring to that you're opposed to that aspect of the bill, and that's the focus of your...
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative King, if I could clarify that. And as I stated in my prepared remarks, Reynolds, in general, is supportive of the purpose of this bill and would support competition. And in other parts of the country, we would do the same. Our focus here today is on the public purpose charge, which, as I said in response to a question of Representative Simmons, is the only way that we are even included in this bill. There is nothing else that touches us on this bill other than the net being cast broader than the distribution utility to collect monies out of the aluminum plant. So if our issue is addressed, if we could become exempted from the bill for the good policy reasons I stated, we would strongly support passage of this bill.
I think I saw Mr. Beck's head nodding that he
provides it. Yes, sir. I am here as a joint effort with Reynolds to sway this bill to be amended to exempt Reynolds from this tax. Myself, my own opinion, and political opinions.
Thank you. Representative Montgomery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How many more people we have testified? But with all due respect, I think we've had three so far today, and each one of them has amendments. So by the time they all three get through this amendment, you better read that bill again before you say you support it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Montgomery, that's good, a good caution. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I would urge the committee to look at the letter from Representative Menes relative to this issue involving Reynolds on Senate Bill 1149. She wanted to be here today, but I think she had a conflict in terms of the committee hearing she had to be involved in. But she has come to me and talked to me about the issue, and she's put this letter forth. Any other questions for the folks here for Reynolds? If not, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Hummel.
I do have one question. Are they intending to have their amendment actually drafted, or...
I can tell you, Representative Kremel, that Mr. Waddington has been in discussions with a number of the proponents of this bill, and there's been a number of different ideas discussed, and I'm sure there will be some kind of an amendment coming forth to deal with this issue in some fashion. I don't know exactly right now what that will say, but they have been in the loop on this certainly for the last 10 or 14 days that I'm aware of. I noticed that former Representative Carter is here. Did you want to come forth and say anything, Representative?
No.
Okay. Is there anybody else who would like to give testimony today on Senate Bill 1149? Our plan is to have this bill back up on Friday for public hearing and possible work session. What I would do is I would encourage folks who have been moving this bill forward to work constructively with the folks from Reynolds and the people from Pacific Corp to give consideration to their proposals and see if we can't work on some language that we can get some agreement on those concerns. And Friday, I would hope that we'll have some, hopefully as close to unanimity as we can on some of those issues. Anything else, committee? If not, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1149, and we are adjourned.